You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey there. If you haven't listened to the last episode, Babble On, I highly recommend doing so before going forward with this one, since this will be a sort of continuation of that story. Not quite a part two, but pretty close. As a refresher, for most of the last 2,000 years, lots of people believed in an original, natural language from which all other languages sprang. For the Abrahamic religions, this language was usually thought to be the tongue spoken by God and/or Adam, and therefore it was the true language, the real names of things, and held magical power. And, for the Abrahamic religions, the panoply of languages that exist today were a result of the Tower of Babel, when God confused the tongues of man. From there, we can divide the proponents of the true language into two camps. Those who believed that the original language was still spoken, that when God struck Babel, he created new languages but also preserved the old language, and those who thought he splintered that original tongue in the process, removing it from human knowledge. For those who thought that the Adamic language was still out there, there were a lot of possible contenders. Dutch, Spanish, Italian, Greek, Gaelic, Celtic, German, Chinese, Egyptian, Arabic, Sanskrit, you name it. But for most, the answer was assumed to be Hebrew, since it was the language in which the book of Genesis was written, and because Hebrew was thought to have deeper, mystical significance in its words. The people who felt Adamic was no longer spoken usually thought that, nevertheless, it could be retrieved, that because it was the truth, it could never really die out. Some felt you could discover Adamic through obsessively thorough research of the Torah. Others felt that logic, or else nature itself, ought to provide the true names of things, while still others thought it could be discovered through magic, appealing to sorcery, to birds, to angels, even to God himself. In Babble On, we mostly focused on these Abrahamic theories, those held by European, West Asian, and North African Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And a lot of our time today will be spent on them too, but it's important to say that while the specifics of the Adamic language were based on the book of Genesis, the broader idea that there was an original tongue is far wider spread. Most peoples of the world, for most of history, have shared a similar belief. And perhaps rightly so. Even today, we don't know whether all extant human languages share a common ancestor. It's an extraordinarily tough question to answer, and in spite of a lot of very clever research over the last 100-odd years, there is no scientific consensus. This field is truly fascinating and is one of several which I am going to try my best to skip over, both because I don't know what I'm talking about and because it's not the story we're here for. But it's worth considering some of the questions at the root of modern debates over whether there was a shared linguistic ancestor. Like, when did language first arise? If people only started talking to one another once the human population was decentralized and spread out, then it's extremely unlikely that everything can be traced back to one mother tongue. Although, even in this event, it's not impossible. It could be that separate populations of people independently invented unrelated languages, but that all the languages passed down to modern time stem from just one of them while the others went extinct. Just like the shared common ancestor of all now existent life on Earth doesn't have to have been the first life. Maybe some early Homo sapien populations wordlessly separated from one another and each created its own language, but all but one of those populations died or was permanently isolated. Or maybe one band of people came back and colonized all the rest and that language won out over the others. You're starting to see why this question is so difficult? But let's assume that the first language was invented when all people, or all people whose ancestors survived at least, were together. That there was one human community that shared a common tongue. That doesn't mean that all the languages today descend from it. Maybe when we began to spread out around the world and splinter into lots of smaller communities, not every one of those communities kept touch with our shared language. Maybe some small group of people got isolated and lost it or rejected it and started over with a fresh new language. What we're really asking is how easily language is created and how easily it endures. All human populations ever observed have a language, which means either that we naturally and quickly create languages whenever we need one, or that once we created one, it was incredibly difficult to get rid of. That debate, though, rests upon an assumption that isn't quite universal. For all human languages to have a common ancestor, all humans must have one too. Today, we're about as sure as we can get that we do. Our understanding of DNA and evolution pretty well preclude the possibility that humans erupted in several places independently. All humans, everywhere in the world, are the same species, and that means we're all related. Most everyone we talked about in part one also believed in a shared common ancestor, but for a very different reason. They knew who those ancestors were, Adam and Eve. Genesis was not especially ambiguous about this, and for most of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim history, doubting it was heresy. Nevertheless, around the same time that John Dee was trying to translate the missives sent to him by the angels through Edward Kelly, some alternative ideas started cropping up. The main thing that challenged the Judeo-Christian idea that all people came from Adam and Eve was the same thing that challenged so many Judeo-Christian ideas in the 16th century: the New World. When Europeans landed in the Americas, they discovered a lot of things that weren't accounted for in Scripture, and one of the biggest enigmas was the native peoples that they encountered almost everywhere they went, especially once it dawned on everybody that Columbus was wrong and hadn't actually reached the far side of Asia. Europeans couldn't rightly account for how the children of Adam had gotten from Eden to the Bahamas. They didn't have any of the ideas that might explain it. They didn't know about plate tectonics. They didn't know about a possible land bridge across the Bering Strait from Asia to North America. Hell, they didn't know what was on the far side of North America to begin with. So they began thinking up possible solutions given the ideas they did have to work with. Europeans began looking at Genesis more closely, trying to riddle out a way that multiple lines of humans could have been created somewhere in the subtext. Such a reading of Genesis already existed. In the writings of the 2nd century Gnostic Christian Valentinus, he posited that the serpent in the garden could have seduced Eve, and that Cain was the result of that coupling. This meant that there were two lines of humans, and one of them was evil. As the Gnostic Gospel of Philip put it, first adultery came into being, afterward murder. And Cain was begotten in adultery, for he was the child of the serpent. So he became a murderer, just like his father, and he killed his brother. Indeed, every act of sexual intercourse which has occurred between those who are unlike one another is an act of adultery. So in case you're keeping track, that's racism, misogyny, and anti-misogynation in one fell swoop. It's like watching the Senate interview a possible Supreme Court justice. But neither Valentinus nor the author of the Gospel of Philip gained much purchase. In fact, they were generally seen as heretics. The idea that the serpent was the father of Cain never fully went away. It was written about by both medieval Christians and Jews, but it was an extremely unimportant view. Up until the 1870s, when a group of British nationalists, who believed they were the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel, rekindled it in a bid to religiously entrench white supremacy. Oh, that's fun. From there, the serpent seed theory was taken up by the Ku Klux Klan, the Christian Identity Movement, the American Nazi Party, and the Aryan Nations. I think you can probably piece together why. Even if Cain was the son of Adam and Eve, which any reasonable reading would assume, there was still an issue. After Cain killed Abel, God cursed him and sent him off to toil. But he gave Cain a wife, and Cain built with her a city. So where did she come from, and where the city? In 1655, Isaac LaPierre published Pre Adamate, in which he argued that Adam wasn't the first person, but the first Jewish person, and that a population of Gentiles must have existed before him, whom Cain went off with after murdering his brother. Others advocated for the theory that there were multiple Adams all across the world, and that the Bible followed the story and descendants of just one. With the beginning of the Enlightenment came a new path towards understanding, a secular one. Philosophers like David Hume and Voltaire, physicians like John Atkins and Charles White, and scientists like Jean-Baptiste Bory de Saint-Vincent and Georges Cuvier all believed and argued vociferously that the Bible was wrong and that humanity shared no common ancestor. There were multiple different species or races of humans, at least three of them, Caucasians, Asians, and Africans, if not more. This idea of racialism was partly inspired by the physical separation of different populations and partly inspired by a growing empiricism that was skeptical of biblical accuracy. But it's clear that for most supporters, the real issue of racialism was just racism. Denying all people a common humanity justified chattel slavery, the seizing of land, the taking of resources, and genocide. But the invention of race is a much larger topic for another time. For the topic at hand, what's important to know is that by the 18th century, leading scientific thought was that there were multiple human origins, not one. And, therefore, there was no one original language, no true Hebrew to be found. If you're keeping track, we are now sitting on a whole host of possible answers to the original language question. It could be Hebrew. It could be Greek. It could be Dutch, Spanish, Italian, Chinese, Egyptian, Celtic, Gaelic, or any other vernacular now spoken in the world. Or it could be a secret language known only to some group of elite elect. Or it could be known to no one, but knowable by studying nature, or scripture, or magic. Or it could be gone forever, or never have existed in the first place. And either of those things, too, could be true for a dozen different reasons. And even if the original language was fully and completely extinct, or never had existed in the first place, the issue still pointed to other questions, like how people come up with language at all, where it comes from, and how durable it is. No matter what horse you backed, there was little you could do to prove it. People devised all kinds of arguments and experiments, but none of them moved the needle. Supporters of any and all propositions were locked in a hopeless war of attrition. So much so that in the 1880s, the Linguistic Society of Paris banned all related discussion. There was no way to know, so it was best if everyone would just stop trying. Except that there was one way. An experiment most people were aware of, but all were too timid to try. If you truly wanted to know what the natural language was, or at least how and if language is formed spontaneously, all you had to do was sequester a number of babies in a wordless world. Lock them up and hide them away without any access to speech. Devise some way to care for their base needs and wait. Wait until they were 10 or 15, and then go and see if and what they spoke. Of course, such an experiment would be morally reprehensible. Even the loose scientific ethics of the 18th and 19th centuries couldn't abide such a hideous experiment. But maybe they didn't have to. Because deep in the historical record, there were four stories of four kings not bound by pedestrian ideas of right and wrong, each of whom had supposedly performed the awful feat. Today, we're talking about them. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, The Forbidden Experiment. We'll be right back. Four separate kings, four separate experiments, but they share a lot in common. Monarchy is a weird form of government. It concentrates the power of the state in the hands of one person, which turns the state into something of a magnifying glass, an upscaler for enlarging the idiosyncrasies and particulars of its leader. Most people, after all, are mostly the same in a zoomed-out, day-to-day sort of sense. But when a person's every thought and whim and preference is shot through the enormous prism of national policy, the differences and deviations take on huge proportions. So it's hard to say what an average king is. The four kings of this story, however, were very much not. I can say that because we know quite a bit about three of them. The other one is more of a mystery. And he's where we're starting. Pharaoh Psamtik I. The reason Psamtik is more of an unknown is simple. He ruled over Egypt between 664 and 610 BC, and records of that time and place are spotty at best. Much of what we know about Psamtik, including his search for the true language, comes from Herodotus, who was Greek, not Egyptian, and lived roughly 200 years after Psamtik. Not to mention that while Herodotus is often, quite generously, called the father of history, the history he fathered is not especially dependable, even when he's talking about things not removed from his personal experience by a few thousand miles and two centuries. What we do know about Psamtik is that he came to power under extremely turbulent circumstances. His father was Necho I, who ruled over the city of Sais. He was installed to that position by the Assyrian king Esarhaddon, who had just invaded, conquered, and divided Egypt into a dozen splintered city-states, kicking out the ruling Kushites. But the Kushites came back to reclaim Egypt and killed Necho, driving Psamtik into exile in Syria. Then the Assyrians marched back in and pushed the Kushites out again, and Psamtik was put in charge of both Sais and Memphis. There was, briefly, a period of peace and co-governance among the various kinglets of Egypt. But it was broken, according to Herodotus, when Psamtik offered a libation from a bronze cup at the temple of Hephaestus. And this is one of those really undependable bits of Herodotus, because according to him, all the other kinglets understood that there was a prophecy that whoever did this would become pharaoh of all Egypt. And yet, according to Herodotus, Psamtik, who fulfilled the prophecy, was the only one unaware of it. So the other rulers forced him out of Memphis. From his exile in the Nile swamps, Psamtik then organized an alliance with King Gyges of Lydia, who sent an army to help Psamtik reclaim the country. He killed or pushed out the other kinglets, and by 657 had taken full control of Egypt. There were many, many more Psamtik wars to come. He impressed himself upon Thebes, successfully invaded Libya, laid siege to Ashdod, and so on and so on. But to Herodotus, the most important thing about Psamtik and the story that he writes up first in his account of Egypt is the story of the experiment. Once again, it is important to keep in mind that everything we know of this experiment comes solely from Herodotus, and we'll go over exactly what that tells us or fails to tell us down the line. But according to the father of history, the Egyptians believed, up until Psamtik, that they were the original people, the first civilization on Earth. This gels with the story of one of the other so-called fathers of history, Hecataeus of Miletus. We covered Hecataeus' story in our episode, The Lead Age, but the gist of it goes like this. About 100 years before Herodotus and after Psamtik, Hecataeus visited the Egyptian temple at Thebes and told the priests there that he could track his genealogy back to the Greek gods and to the beginning of time, some 16 generations back. But the Thebeans had statues in the temple of high priests going back 345 generations, and so the Greek origin of the world was disproved. Of course, the problem here is that Hecataeus' encounter with the Thebeans is only attested to by Herodotus later in his account of Egypt, so the whole thing is a bit of an Eros-Boros, but hey, Eros-Boros comes from Egyptian myth too, so maybe Herodotus was onto something anyway. Is that how logic works? Anyway, Herodotus accepted that Egyptian society was older than Greek society, but whether or not it was the first society was in question, and that question, according to Herodotus, was first raised by Psamtik. Apparently, when Samtik took control, there was a rumor that the Phrygians, I told you last time to remember the Phrygians, predated the Egyptians, and Samtik wanted to know for sure. When no one could definitively convince him one way or the other, he devised his experiment. To quote Herodotus, "He gave two newborn babes of ordinary men to a shepherd to nurture among his flock after this manner. He charged him that none should utter any speech before them, but they should live by themselves in a solitary habitation, and at the due hours the shepherd should bring goats to them and give them their fill of milk and perform the other things needful. Thus Samtik did and commanded because he desired, when the babes should be past meaningless whimperings, to hear what tongue they would utter first." Samtik's version of this experiment is the first and the prototypical example of what we're here for. It has every necessary element that the others will include. For starters, Samtik doesn't believe that one isolated baby will do. Maybe that's just a failsafe against infant mortality, a wise one given the era, but it seems safe to assume that Samtik believed that you needed more than one person to make speech, that a talker needed someone to talk to. He also understood the most obvious difficulty of the experiment. Babies are helpless, and left in true isolation, will only learn one thing, how to die. So, there must be some carefully constructed method that will preserve their lives while denying them anything like human communication, which is a pretty tall order. Samtik entrusts this duty to a shepherd, who should treat them not like children, but like any other animal in his flock. And since the shepherd has plenty of goats, he can give the youngins milk without introducing a human woman who might confound the experiment with her compassion. Finally, Samtik's version rests upon the most important presupposition of this experiment, that whatever the original language might be, in this case either Egyptian or Phrygian, it must be innate. The true tongue automatically resides inside of all people and only fails to manifest because it is typically interrupted by the influence of others. This, obviously, is the most bizarre predicate of the whole thing and the most difficult to justify. And yet, as we will see over the course of all four of our kings, it must have seemed totally reasonable to most people in most of the world over most of history. I wish I had more to say about this because it feels like it deserves a lot more turning over, but I don't know what to make of it. Maybe I'll drum something up for the end of the episode. For now, let's get back to Samtik's experiment, which, if it really was done, might be eligible to be called the first scientific experiment in human history, a century before Anaximander and Anaximenes brought empirical experimentation to Ionia. The closest competitor to Samtik is King Croesus of Lydia, who supposedly tested the accuracy of the Greek oracles by sending messengers to ask them what he would be doing on the 100th day of the year. The correct answer was boiling a lamb and a tortoise in a bronze cauldron, which, amazingly, the Oracle of Delphi managed to predict. Of course, this story too comes to us through Herodotus, so, well, you know. Anyway, Herodotus says that after 2 years of being fed goat milk and wordlessly raised as livestock, the shepherd was instructed to open his gates, approach the children, and see what they said. When he walked up to the kids, they put their hands out to him and begged something. The word they said, according to the shepherd, according to Samtik, according to Herodotus, was bekos. Bekos, bekos. Over and over again, they said bekos. When the shepherd brought the two-year-olds to Samtik, they said it to him, too, bekos. But what was bekos? Samtik asked his court and was told it meant bread in Phrygian. Writes Herodotus, "Thus the Egyptians, guided by this sign, confessed that the Phrygians were elder than they." So, there you have it. Samtik had two babies raised silently on goat milk who, after 2 years in isolation, spontaneously spoke the Phrygian word for bread, thus proving that Phrygian was the true mother tongue. It's a great story in itself, you can see why Herodotus opened his book with it, but it's once you start trying to break it down that it gets truly scrumptious. Let's peel it away one layer at a time. Start by assuming the entire thing is 100% factually correct, that Herodotus totally nailed it. What would that mean? Not much, really. Becos meant bread in Phrygian, sure, but in Portuguese it means alleys. In Middle English, it's the same as because. And, most intriguingly, Becos meant elephant tusk in ancient Egyptian, the very language Psamtik spoke, and the one he presumably hoped would win out. A lot of Herodotus commentators over the millennia have noted that Becos is also a very baby babble kind of sound. In the 1600s, the German alchemist and physician Daniel Sennert argued that Becos was the onomatopoeic sound of a goat bleeding, which the children could have mimicked since that was their food source and the closest thing they would have known to a mother. Which is intriguing, but still rests upon this having actually happened as Herodotus wrote, which is a hell of a presumption. Herodotus claims that he learned of the experiment through the priests at the Temple of Hephaestus in Memphis. And he says that he traveled to Thebes and Heliopolis to confirm the story. He doesn't explicitly say that the Theban and Hellenes priests did, and that seems to be the implication, though. The best reason to believe the account is to ask the old Latin question, qui bono? Who profits? In our last episode, Babylon, we talked a lot about people who went searching for the original language and coincidentally concluded that it was the language they spoke in the first place. The Irish thought it was Gaelic, the Dutch that it was Dutch, the Germans German, and so forth. Aside from the level of detail in Herodotus' telling and the effort he went through to corroborate it, the thing that stands out about it is that no one along the possible chain of authorship wins. If it were an Egyptian story, it reflected poorly on the Egyptians. Their claim of human primacy was dashed, thrown aside for those blasted Phrygians. But if instead it was Herodotus who made it up, or Hecateus, whom Herodotus might have cribbed from, then why wasn't the ultimate answer Greek? There are no Phrygians anywhere in the chain of custody, yet they're the ultimate winners here. There's so little known about Psamtik's experiment and about Psamtik himself that it's impossible to say for sure whether it was truly performed or not. But it probably wasn't. The key detail is that claim at being the earliest experiment. There's virtually no reason to think that Psamtik or anyone else at the time was acquainted with building anything like a scientific experiment, much less one as carefully constructed and ethically questionable as this one. It does, however, sound quite a lot like the sorts of early experiments being conducted a bit later by Anaximander and Anaximenes in Miletus. Miletus also happens to be the hometown of Hecateus, the guy from whom Herodotus is likely to have cribbed. So it starts to look like maybe Herodotus misunderstood Hecateus, or even invented the Psamtik story inspired by Hecateus. The best indication is one damning fact. The Egyptians didn't drink goat's milk. And the Ionians did. Scratch off Phrygian. On to experiment number two. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. People don't always realize that physical symptoms like headaches, teeth grinding, and even digestive issues can be indicators of stress. And let's not forget about doom scrolling, sleeping too much, sleeping too little, undereating, and overeating. For me, it's all of the above, frankly, sometimes simultaneously. Stress shows up in all kinds of ways, and in a world that's telling you to do more, sleep less, and grind all the time, here's your reminder to take care of yourself, do less, and maybe try some therapy. My time in therapy has been a lifesaver, maybe literally, and I recommend it to anyone and everyone. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Constant listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/theconstant. That's BETTERHELP.com/theconstant. Hunting down answers to your questions can be rewarding. When it comes to hiring, you don't always have as much time as you'd like to spend finding great candidates with the right skills. That's why there's Indeed, the best hiring partner your team can get. If you're hiring, you need Indeed, because Indeed is the hiring partner where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. And Indeed is the only job site where you're guaranteed to find quality applications that meet your must-have requirements or else you don't pay. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites hoping to find the candidates with the right skills, you need one powerful hiring partner that can help you do it all. Indeed partners with you on every step of the hiring process. Find great talent through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates with resumes on Indeed that match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. Plus, you only pay for quality applications that meet your must-have requirements. I love that Indeed makes hiring all in one place so easy. So, join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring right now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/theconstant. Offer valid through April 30th. Go to Indeed.com/theconstant to claim your $75 credit before April 30th. Indeed.com/theconstant. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. No two monarchs are alike, but few are as unique as our second subject, Emperor Frederick II. Frederick was the son of Emperor Henry VI, born the day after Christmas 1194. Henry took ill during a hunting trip when Frederick was just 3 years old and died, probably of malaria. At the time, the title of Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire wasn't inherited, but Henry tried to secure it for the baby Frederick anyway, and partially succeeded. Upon word of Henry's death, civil war broke out in Germany over the rightful emperor. So Frederick's mother, Constance of Sicily, took him back to southern Italy and separated the kingdom of Sicily from the empire. Frederick was named King of Sicily, with Constance acting as queen regent. Unfortunately for Constance, she followed Henry, dying almost immediately after securing the crown for her son. The next few years were pretty rough on young Freddy. He was 4 years old, King of Sicily, and both his parents were dead. A whole lot of people wanted control of his kingdom, but to get it, they would have to literally grab hold of a small child, which naturally they did. First came Pope Innocent III, who was happy to act as King Regent of Sicily and protector of Frederick, because he was just a swell guy. And also he was looking to permanently expand and empower his papacy. But after a few years, Frederick's uncle, Philip of Swabia, showed up to save him from the Pope's clutches. Unfortunately, Philip was also one of the guys vying for the title of Holy Roman Emperor. He gave control of Sicily to a series of German soldiers who basically abandoned Frederick to wander the streets of Palermo. When he was 14, he assumed the crown properly, asserted his rule, and kicked all the Germans out of Sicily. By then, Uncle Philip had been assassinated, and Otto of Brunswick was Holy Roman Emperor, blessed by Pope Innocent himself. Until Otto decided to invade Sicily and depose Frederick. What's important to understand here is that the Vatican was surrounded. To their south was Frederick Sicily, to their north was the Empire. So the most important thing to the Pope was making sure that they were ruled by different and hopefully opposing people. If either Otto or Frederick were to control both, they could pinch their borders and destroy the Catholic Church. So, Innocent excommunicated Otto and backed Frederick to be the new king of Germany. It took another 10 years or so to be made official, read for everyone to stop killing one another over it, but in 1220, Frederick II became Holy Roman Emperor and delivered a series of promises to Honorius III, the pope who succeeded Innocent. For starters, Frederick had to promise not to unite Sicily, where he was king, with Rome, where he was now emperor. No problem, said Frederick. How about we just say my wife is in charge of Sicily? Your wife? The Pope responded skeptically. Okay, fine. My son, then. Honorius was understandably uneasy, but agreed to back him because of the other promise. If I name you emperor, he said, you must wage a crusade to take back Jerusalem from the Muslims. Sure, sure, I'll get right on it, said Frederick. He did not. Frederick had no interest in crusading to Jerusalem. He was a social reformer, interested in matters at home. Also, he thought Muslims were pretty okay. He invited them to his court, and Jews, too, forming a sort of medieval cosmopolitan society. The thing he craved more than anything else, even more than power, was knowledge. In an era of unwavering religious devotion, he was skeptical of the church, of the supernatural. Some thought he might even be an atheist. In the Inferno, Dante placed him in the sixth ring of hell, to be burned in a tomb for all eternity. His crime? Epicureanism, which is really to say that he sought pleasure and knowledge, and that he didn't fear God. And he really did seek pleasure and knowledge. He had four wives, spoke nine languages. He was also excommunicated three separate times, so there might be something to that last charge, too. Frederick was more interested in intellectual concerns than military ones, and he repeatedly endangered the Christian crusaders by failing to join them. I should say, he eventually did march on and seize Jerusalem, but seeing as he was excommunicated at the time, whether this counted as bringing Christianity back to the city or not was up for debate. But mostly he stuck around Italy, learning what he could about whatever interested him. He founded the University of Naples, the world's oldest state university. He assembled a menagerie of animals that came with him on all his travels. Lions, bears, apes, camels, the first giraffe on record to come to Europe, and the first elephant since Hannibal. He was especially interested in birds. His retinue was full of them, including an ostrich, which was his pride and joy. He encouraged discourse. He questioned orthodoxy, including taking a few solid public swipes at the writings of fucking Aristotle back when that was a capital offense. And, according to Salimbene de Adam, he performed experiments. And here's where things get equal parts wild and confusing. Salimbene de Adam is a remarkably unreliable source on all things Frederick. He was a Franciscan monk, a staunch supporter of the Catholic Church, and clearly had a bone to pick with the thrice excommunicated emperor, as evinced by a booklet he wrote entitled The 12 Calamities of Emperor Frederick II. That's not where we get his account of Frederick's experiments, though. Instead, they came from his Chronica, which professes to be a complete history of the years 1167 to 1287. All the same, Salimbene's agenda against Frederick wasn't subtle. Add to that, Salimbene never actually knew or even met Frederick, and that his is the only record of Frederick's experiment, and things start to seem pretty dubious. On the other hand, there is no doubt that Frederick was interested in the sorts of things Salimbene accuses him of investigating. And while Salimbene's more salacious descriptions, like the one we're here for, are uncorroborated, we do know that Frederick did perform some similar experiments, which Salimbene includes in his chronicle. For instance, Frederick and his court confirm Salimbene's story that the emperor caught a fish and secured a copper ring through its gills before releasing it, in an attempt to figure out how long fish live. And certainly, nothing Salimbene says Frederick did would have been beyond the emperor's power to make happen. The other two experiments he describes, which really raise eyebrows, were said to have been conducted on prisoners. In one, Salimbene says that Frederick had a convict locked in a barrel, without food or water, and with only a single hole on top from which he could breathe. That wasn't the hole's primary purpose, though. The goal of the experiment was to observe whether the condemned's soul would visibly escape through the hole at the moment of his death. In the second prisoner experiment, Salimbene wrote that Frederick had two prisoners fed the same meal and then had one confined to his cell to sleep while the other was taken out for exercise. After a few hours, he had both of them disemboweled, so he could see whether one or the other of them had digested more of their food. Salimbene says nothing of the results of either of these experiments, but he does tell us the outcome of the one we're here for, and that outcome provides perhaps the best reason to think it actually happened. Quoting from the Chronica, "Like Psamtik in Herodotus, he made linguistic experiments on the vile bodies of hapless infants, bidding foster mothers and nurses to suckle and bathe and wash the children, but in no wise to prattle or speak with them. For he would have learnt whether they would speak the Hebrew language, which had been the first, or Greek, or Latin, or Arabic, or perchance the tongue of their parents of whom they had been born. But he labored in vain, for the children could not live without clappings of the hands, and gestures, and gladness of countenance, and blandishments." In Salimbene's telling, the experiment was a failure, because the children didn't make it to speaking age, having died first from neglect. This idea, that kids would languish without affection and socialization, has no known predecessor. It's not a possibility that anyone seems to have considered for centuries to come. And it's something we now know to be quite true. Still, that the babies all died from lack of attention is a more severe outcome than we might expect. I don't know. When it comes to Psamtik's experiment, I'd say it's more likely than not a fiction. I'm not confident, but leaning. With Emperor Frederick's, I have no lean. It seems equally plausible to me that the science-obsessed and powerful leader performed it, as it is that the devout Franciscan made it up to besmirch him. I don't think you can make a convincing case one way or the other. Now, the last two kingly language experiments, however, are far easier to nail down, for fantastically interesting reasons.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Two experiments left to go. One of them very probably happened, and one of them almost certainly did not. And how we know that is one of my favorite pieces of deductive history ever done. But first, the rulers alleged to have conducted them. One of them is King James IV of Scotland, who we already discussed a bit back in the second part of What Goes Up. King James resembles Emperor Frederick in a whole host of ways. Each of them kept huge menageries of exotic animals, and smaller menageries of human curiosities, which, for James, included a pair of conjoined twins whom he forced to sing in harmony for his court. Each of them founded institutes of higher learning. For James, it was the Royal College of Surgeons. Each of them was preoccupied by the idea of science and experimentation. Frederick tagged fish, but James forced his subjects to let him bleed them and extract their teeth medicinally. And like Frederick, James was a polyglot, reportedly having spoken 7 languages. Oh, and he also ruled during a particularly tumultuous period of British history, but I'm saving that for later. The other monarch left to cover is Akbar the Great, who reigned over the Mughal Empire for the latter half of the 1500s. The Mughals had started out the century controlling a wide swath of modern Uzbekistan and Afghanistan before beginning to chip away at northwest India, which at the time was split among more than a dozen small kingdoms. When Akbar was born in 1542, the Mughals had been repelled entirely out of the subcontinent, and he was raised in exile in Kabul by his uncle. His uncle taught him warfare, combat, and hunting, but not how to read. Nevertheless, Akbar showed a sharp intellect that, like the other subjects of this episode, deeply defied convention. His father, Humayun, reclaimed northwest India and then abruptly died, leaving the teenage Akbar in charge of the newly reconstituted Mughal Empire, which he went on to greatly expand. By the end of his reign, he'd more than doubled the size of his kingdom, controlling most of India and ruling with a mix of martial cleverness and diplomatic tolerance. Akbar's empire was far more cosmopolitan even than Frederick's. It sort of had to be, since he oversaw a huge range of peoples, Sunni, Sufi, and Shia Muslims, Jains, Buddhists, Hindus, Zoroastrians, Sabians, and even relatively large Jewish and Christian populations. But Akbar didn't just accept diversity out of political expediency. While he never learned to read, he never stopped hungering for knowledge, and he found it everywhere. He had his court read to him texts of science, philosophy, and religion almost daily, and from pretty early on, he didn't restrict these recitations to Orthodox Muslim teachings. In 1575, when he was 24 years old, he built the Ibadat Khana, or Hall of Worship, at his palace near Agra. While the Hall of Worship might sound like some sort of religious temple or shrine, it was more accurately a hall to worship wisdom and debate. It was built in the sign of a cross, with 4 wings facing a center, and in each wing would be representatives of some way of thinking, who could then present, debate, and argue with one another. At the very beginning, the 4 wings were occupied by 4 different groups of Muslims. But after a few years, his tolerance for dissent grew larger, and he encouraged peoples of all faiths, and even lack of faith, to come and give their thoughts. This level of religious pluralism was basically unheard of anywhere in the world. In the 1580s, you could come and see Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, Hindus, Zoroastrians, and more, all sharing their ideas, debating their merits with one another before the emperor. He wrote to King Philip II of Spain in 1582, explaining how he brought together learned men of all religions, thus depriving profit from their exquisite discourses and exalted aspirations. Too many people, he told Philip, didn't investigate religion honestly, instead following, quote, the religion in which they were born and educated, thus excluding themselves from the possibility of ascertaining the truth, which is the noblest aim of the human intellect. The same year that he dictated that letter to Philip, he began merging all the religions he knew about into one new one that he expected to be universal, the Dini Ilahi, or Religion of God. It was a noble, if futile, experiment. Oh, speaking of experiments, let's get back to them. So, Akbar and James, each of them reportedly conducted an experiment to find the true language. One of them most likely did, the other almost certainly did not. But unless you're a Patreon subscriber, you probably don't have the tools to make a good guess yet. Hey, it's a 50-50 shot though, so place your bets, I guess. In 1578, at the Ibadat Khana, there was a debate over the original divine language. Akbar was of the opinion that there was no such thing. Like religions, he thought that each child learned their mode of speech from their tribe, and stated that if a baby was raised without that tribe, they would not learn to speak. But he conceded that if such a child did speak, that he would be proven wrong, and that whatever language the babe uttered would have to be the divine one. His constituents were unconvinced, so Akbar constructed a building in the middle of nowhere, a place where no people were known to reside. In it, he confined some number of infants, along with some mute wet nurses and a retinue of royal guards outside. After 4 years, Akbar and his court went hunting in the area and entered the place which had become known as the Gong Mahal, or Dumb House. When they entered, they heard nothing. The four-year-old children didn't speak at all and made no sound other than what his advisor and historian Abul Fazil called the noise of the dumb. King James's experiment went quite differently. He is said to have sent two babies and a mute woman to the uninhabited island of Inchkeith in the Firth of Forth, a couple of miles north of Edinburgh. According to Robert Lindsay, they were abandoned there until they were of, quote, "lawchful age." What that means is up for debate. Scottish law held that children were pupils until the boys reached the age of 14 and the girls the age of 12. But Catholic dogma said they were innocents until their 7th birthdays. So at least 7 years, if not double that. Then they were brought back to civilization where the results were demonstrated. Now, this is a problem with the King James story, because just what those results were is disputed. According to Lindsay, they spoke, quote, "good Hebrew." But John Pinkerton said the children spoke, well, something else, some unknown language, whether it was meaningless babble or some secret tongue of their own co-creation, Pinkerton was unsure. And you might be tempted to accept Pinkerton's version and reject Lindsay's, since the latter's lined up so perfectly with the prejudice of the time. As we've said many times now, most Europeans assumed Hebrew to be the Adamic language. But Pinkerton's version also shows a certain kind of bias. He wrote it in the early 1800s, some 300 years after Lindsay. And in the early 1800s, the European intelligentsia was obsessed by the story of Victor of Aveyron, a supposedly feral child who had been raised alone in the wilderness and who did not talk. That tale held serious sway with intellectuals of the time, like Pinkerton, and thus, he might have expected the children to be semi or nonverbal. And it's not clear who Pinkerton got his version of the story from. He cites two sources: Lindsay himself, with whom he clearly disagreed, and another Scottish historian, George Buchanan. But Buchanan's existent writings say nothing about the experiment. So it's anyone's guess just what and where Pinkerton's conclusion stems from. But, enough about that. We've got our two experiments, Akbar's and James's. Which one is the real one? And they both seem like strong candidates. Both rulers were powerful, interested in truth and philosophy, and each of them regularly bucked convention and engaged in just this sort of unorthodox stunt. But of the four instances of these language deprivation experiments, the only one we can say occurred with any solid degree of confidence is Akbar's. The reason all comes down to sourcing. While Abul Fazil's version is the most detailed and the closest to Akbar's court, it's not by any means alone. The Sunni historian Abdul Qadir Badayuni tells almost exactly the same story, except that he adds that most of the children died shortly after the experiment's conclusion. And Badayuni is an interesting counterweight. Unlike Abul, who was a close friend and confidant to Akbar, Badayuni hated the emperor, precisely because of his liberal religious attitudes. That two men, politically and philosophically opposed, give nearly identical versions of the story? It's pretty intriguing. That's not all, though. In 1579, Akbar invited a group of Jesuit missionaries to his court. The Jesuits thought that they were there to convert everyone to Catholicism, but soon figured out that Akbar only wanted them to fill out his debate team. I love Akbar the Great. Still, they stuck around, and one of the Jesuit leaders, Hieronymus Xavier, also backs up the story of the experiment. He wrote a letter to a compatriot back in Europe saying that Akbar himself had explained to Xavier how he had conducted it. And again, it mostly lines up, except that Xavier says nothing about Akbar having anticipated the outcome. So that's one friend, one enemy, and one foreigner, all agreeing contemporaneously that the experiment was done. And that is about as good as history gets. The King James Version, not that King James Version, is a lot spottier right out of the gate. James kept a lot of writers at his court, including the aforementioned George Buchanan and the poet William Dunbar, but none of them say anything about throwing babies on an island. The closest source, and practically the only source, is Robert Lindsay, but King James was already 20 years in the ground before Lindsay was born. He also kept meticulous financial records. Every penny the alchemist John Damien spent before and after he tried to fly out of Stirling Castle is carefully accounted for, down to the last bottle of booze. But there's nothing in the royal receipts about appointing, homing, or provisioning a mute wet nurse and babies on Inchkeith. That's all fairly bland, though. It's absence of evidence, which, as everybody's favorite pilfering warmonger Donald Rumsfeld reminded us, is not evidence of absence. I said that one of the experiments probably happened, and that we know the other almost definitely did not. And I am overjoyed to be able to explain to you how. When it comes to motive and means, James is a perfect suspect. He was a powerful king with great centralized authority, he was invested in questions of science and philosophy, and he wasn't burdened by a whole lot of ethical qualms. If you had to choose one guy who might have pulled something like this off in all of human history, well, you'd choose Akbar the Great, wouldn't you? But if you had to choose two guys, you might add Emperor Frederick. But if you had to choose three guys, you'd definitely put James in the mix. However, means and motive don't mean anything without opportunity, and that is the real juicy bit of King James's experiment. According to both Lindsay and Pinkerton, James isolated the babies, or bairns, if you Scots prefer, along with supplies and their mute wet nurse on the abandoned island of Inchkeith. So far, so good. Inchkeith isn't too far from the Royal Castle in Edinburgh. It was definitely under James's control, and we know that he used to use it for falconry and hunting. Other than that, Inchkeith was uninhabited. Most of the time. Lindsay also gives us a year for the experiment, 1493, and he gives us a rough idea of how long it went, the minimum being 7 years. Everything else we can say is informed conjecture. There's no record of the experiment other than Lindsay's belated account, and nothing on the royal ledger to suggest it happened either. But neither of those things tell us too much. The king could easily hide spending if, for some reason, he wanted to. Things could have been overlooked, suppressed, or even lost. But for this to have happened, we need Inchkeith to be available and uninhabited for at least a period of 7 years, between 1493 and 1500. And it most definitely and deliciously was not. Strapping for a ride, everybody! We begin 10 years before Lindsay's given start date, and 400 miles south. In April of 1483, King Edward IV of England died in Windsor Castle. His successor was meant to be his eldest son, Edward V, but Eddie V was only 12 years old, so until he came of age, he was given a Lord Protector, everybody's favorite Duke of Gloucester, second favorite hunchback, and third favorite Shakespeare villain, Richard III. Richard pretty much immediately began consolidating power, arresting and executing a bevy of nobles he feared would be sympathetic to his enemies. Those enemies being chiefly two little boys, 12-year-old Edward and his little brother Richard of Shrewsbury, each of whom had a clear line to the throne. But Richard III took care of that easily enough. The boys were the product of King Edward's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville, but Bishop Robert Stillington testified that before that marriage, Edward had fallen in love with Lady Eleanor Talbot and that he had married them in secret. That made Edward IV a bigamist, Edward V and Richard of Shrewsbury bastards, and Richard III the rightful king of England. The boys were remanded to the Tower of London in June. By the end of the summer, they had disappeared. Precisely what happened to the princes in the tower is impossible to say. In Shakespeare's telling, Richard gets his trusted knight, James Tyrell, to murder them in the tower, and while those specifics are Shakespeare's invention, the odds that Richard did indeed have the two kids killed are high. However, there is an alternative possibility, that young Richard of Shrewsbury was spared and fled England. It's a possibility because 7 years later, Richard of Shrewsbury showed up in Burgundy. He told the court there that his brother had been killed, but that the assailant had spared him because of his innocence. Then he was hidden away by a clandestine group of Yorkish loyalists while he prepared to take his rightful place as King of England. It's tough to tell whether this Burgundy party crasher really was Richard or not, and tough to tell whether his supporters believed him. Richard III had been killed in 1485, and the Tudor king Henry VII succeeded him. Richard of Shrewsbury was a York, so those who wanted the Tudors off the throne had motivated reason to support young Richie's claim, even if they didn't really buy it. Now, eventually, this so-called rightful king was captured by Henry VII and confessed that he was, in actuality, Perkin Warbeck, the son of a Belgian comptroller. When he was 17, he traveled to Ireland and learned to speak English. While there, according to his confession, a number of local Yorkists mistook him for Richard, and from there he decided to go with it. All things being equal, the confession is probably true. The names Warbeck gave of relatives in Tournai and Antwerp are backed up by the municipal records of those cities. It is worth saying, however, that said confession was produced through torture. Regardless, Richard of Shrewsbury / Perkin Warbeck spent the 7 years between 1490 and 1497 traveling around Europe and Britain, garnering support, marshaling armies, and attempting, disastrously, to invade England. In the first such disastrous invasion, launched in July of 1495, Warbeck's army was defeated before he could even get off his boat. So, he immediately pushed off and fled to Ireland, where he quickly found he wasn't as welcome as the first time he'd showed up. Where he was welcome, however, was Scotland. King James thought that having a pretender to the English throne around was a pretty good deal. It went right along with the alchemist, the conjoined twins, and the doctor whose teeth he had paid to personally pull. He even went as far as to arrange a marriage for Warbeck to the daughter of his chancellor. And when Perkin Warbeck launched his next English invasion, James's Scottish army joined his ragtag collection of mercenaries and Yorkish loyalists on the field of battle. This invasion was even worse than the first one, and eventually ended with Warbeck in chains confessing his probably true identity and being hung in public view. But that is not the point. The point is that the island of Inchkeith was not available between 1493 and 1500 to house King James's supposed language experiment because of Perkin Warbeck and the ragtag collection of mercenaries and Yorkish loyalists he brought with him to Edinburgh. Or, more to it, because of what the ragtag collection of mercenaries and Yorkish loyalists Perkin Warbeck brought to Edinburgh brought with them. One last jump. 1489, Naples. The king, Ferdinand I, refused to pay dues to Pope Innocent VIII, who responded by excommunicating him, which you might have noticed by now was something popes really enjoyed doing back in the day. Innocent then wrote to the king of France, Charles VIII, and basically said, "If you can take it, Naples is yours." So Charles gave it a go. After finding a bit of local noble infighting that he could use as an excuse, he sent a 25,000-man army to Naples, and by February 1495, they'd taken control of the city. And then the plague began. French soldiers and Napolese peasants started coming down with rashes on the palms of their hands and the soles of their feet, and all across their skin. They developed sores in their mouths and genitals. They had fevers and ulcerations. Their eyes bulged. Eventually, and I really mean eventually, roughly half the infected died, and many more went mad. Each people blamed the other for this new plague. The French called it the disease of Naples, whereas the Napolese called it the French disease. And as it spread across Europe, this trend continued. The Dutch called it the Spanish disease, the Russians called it the Polish disease, and the Ottoman Turks went broader, naming it the Christian disease. Today, you and I call it syphilis. When it arrived in Scotland in 1495, the Scots didn't have anyone to blame other than Perkin Warbeck, whose troops brought it with them. But the Scots were nominally supporting Perkin Warbeck, so they couldn't call it the Burgundy disease or the Yorkish disease or King Edward's plague or whatever. So they gave it a less inflammatory name, Grandgore. And Grandgore became a serious problem in Edinburgh, almost the minute Perkin Warbeck's Burgundian army landed there. By 1497, it was such a problem that a law was passed, the Grandgore Act, which ordered all the syphilitics into, here's a spine-tingling phrase for you, compulsory retirement on the uninhabited island of Inchkeith. That is just 4 years into our minimally 7-year experiment. You can try to smudge the timetable, but for reasons too boring to go into, it doesn't work. Or you can try to move the experiment to some other uninhabited island in the Firth of Forth, but you'll quickly find that any landmass large enough to care for mute children was also turned into a syphilis colony. And that is why we can be pretty darn sure that King James's experiment was never conducted. Ooh, I love it! Where does that leave us? Out of 4 supposed practical attempts to discover the original language, only one of them seems like a safe bet to have actually happened. It would be a moral relief if we could say that all of them were fakes, that nobody ever tried such a brutal thing, that no one would ever subject children to such suffering. But obviously, we know that isn't true. There is a different sense, though, in which the legends of these experiments are surprisingly heartening. To me, it feels bizarre that people from Bronze Age Egypt, medieval India and Italy, and Renaissance Scotland would all seize upon this same story, whether or not each of them tried to actually enact it. Yet they did. And it's clear from the dozens of other arguments, debates, treatises, and investigations we talked about last episode that this is all just the tip of the iceberg. The question that linguists and anthropologists chew over today of whether language evolved just once or many times is very fascinating. But like so many modern scientific endeavors, it lacks a certain spiritual panache that earlier inquiries held. Because the contemporary formulation of whether there was a single modern tongue is basically a question of circumstance. It only seeks to tell us whether things happened in one way or else another. Older ideas of an original language, whatever people called them, are about something much more profound. They're about the assumption that all people, no matter our differences, have something in common. And that if you could find out what exactly that thing is, those differences would be exposed as wallpaper. Sure, none of them were ever able to find it. Whether they consulted books or angels or birds or even locked up babies with mute wet nurses. But everybody, pretty much everybody in the whole world believed. And most of them looked. Which is an absurd and a beautiful bit of irony. That the one thing that binds all people is our belief that there is such a thing. Music for today's episode provided by Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. I'm especially indebted to Drs. Robert N. Campbell and Robert Grieve, who wrote up a fantastically comprehensive paper on the royal language experiments that has yet to be bested. It's called Royal Investigations into the Origin of Languages, and I'll link it in the show notes. Not only did their paper provide most of the groundwork for this episode, but they go into more detail about the specific accounts and what we can deduce from them. Special thanks for this episode go out to all our Patreon supporters, but especially Nate Jenkins, Chad, Katrina Nordine, Rob, Isaac Miller, Brad Rome, Gianluca Onorato, and Barbara Mainwaring for helping make this and every other episode of The Constant possible. If you'd like to join them, go to patreon.com/theconstant to sign up. Do me a favor, if you're listening somewhere that lets you rate and review the show, please do, and tell a friend. Until next time, from Chicago, Illinois, home to the Chicago Linguistics Society, one of the oldest student-run groups in America, whose origins, like the origins of language itself, are a matter of intractable debate, this has been The Constant.